Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Diana Godwin with the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2724 is co-sponsored by the Oregon State Bar and by Thad Geyer, who's with me here today. Thad is a lawyer in Jackson County from Medford. Last session, during the 1985 legislative session, the Oregon State Bar requested that Mr. Geyer come to Salem from Medford to testify on a bill of concern to the Oregon State Bar. It was a bill concerning licensing of so-called legal scriveners. We asked Mr. Thad Geyer to come up to the Sunset Committee and share his experiences in handling some cases that had previously been handled by Scrivener Services. As a result of Mr. Geyer's testimony before a joint House and Senate Sunset Committee, he was sued for giving testimony to a legislative committee. That suit is presently pending in Marion County. And this bill, House Bill 2724, is an attempt to address the question in Oregon of immunity for a witness who testifies before a legislative committee. I've asked Mr. Geyer to be here. I worked with him in drafting this bill, also worked very closely with Representative Stan Bunn from the House Judiciary Committee. And with that, I'll turn that over to Mr. Geyer.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Thad Geyer. I'm the director of the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Medford. The reason that the lawsuit against me for $2 million plus is still pending is because there is no Oregon statute or case law on this topic. A motion to dismiss was submitted to the Circuit Court of Marion County by our attorney, and there being the absence of law on that, the Circuit Court was not willing to dismiss the suit. The issue that I'm bringing up appears to be, at this juncture, at any rate, isolated in Oregon to me, as far as any experiences I know of. However, from simply going to Corpus Juris Segundum and looking up some of the case laws, there's a clear proliferation across the United States now in people wanting to sue witnesses who give testimony on sensitive issues. Such as, for example, in the case of Yip v. Bacano, which is a 1985 federal case, the witness was sued because he testified on gambling regulation in Atlantic City. I have the case of IPB versus Iowa Beef Processors, we are talking about regulation of the meatpacking industry, also another controversial area. And what the general rule is that has been cited by these courts is you have to look to the state law and see whether the state has articulated a position on immunities for witnesses before the legislature. What we are proposing to the Oregon legislature here is really nothing more than the codification of what appears to be the majority rule across the United States. Restatement of Tort Second, Section 590A provides witness in legislative proceedings, quote, a witness is absolutely privileged to publish defamatory matter as part of a legislative proceeding in which he is testifying or in communication preliminary to the proceeding if the matter has some relation to the proceeding, unquote.
What's the authority you just gave us, please?
That is the Restatement of Tort Second, Section 590A.
Now, read that again, will you, please?
Yes. Quote, a witness is absolutely privileged to publish defamatory matter as part of a legislative proceeding in which he is testifying or in communications preliminary to the proceeding if the matter has some relation to the proceeding, unquote.
Is that, and that the section of the restatement was cited to the Marion County Circuit Court, I assume, in your motion?
I didn't author the motion. As I understand it, the motion has been sent here. I believe it to be a very competent Portland firm, and that they cited numerous federal authorities. Whether this specific section was cited, I'm really not aware.
Who is the attorney who represents you in that case?
His name is Ed Sears from the Sweek firm.
You don't know whether that was called to the court's attention?
I don't know whether that particular section was. Similarly, CJS on libel and slander, Section 105 provides, again, the same rule, the privilege of a witness appearing before a committee of the legislature in a matter within the jurisdiction of the committee is the same as that of a witness in a judicial proceeding. A statement made by a witness in such an examination, which is pertinent to the questions and the subject of the examination, is absolutely privileged, unquote. As you can see from House Bill 2724, it's pretty much a statement of the privilege that is set forth in both of these sections, most notably in CJS, but there are a couple of changes. And as I understand it, Representative Bunn did not desire to use the term absolute privilege because there was a concern that we don't want people coming in completely shielded and being able to say whatever they want about anything, whether it's material or immaterial. And as a result of that, the amendments were adopted from the original draft, and now the language includes, unless the witness knowingly makes a false and immaterial statement for the purpose of defaming another. As a result of this, what we're trying to get through is that if you have a witness here and the witness is testifying on a matter that is subject to the business pending before you, then the legislative process is disrupted if you allow the parties to begin suing each other because they don't like the testimony. I would say in conclusion that this becomes a particular concern to me because I represent a number of people who have business before the legislature this year. I believe Senator Hamby is on a committee that deals with one, and that has to do with the bonding requirements for cyanide gold leaching processes. And so I came up here with a bunch of senior citizens who live in a retirement community down there, and they're afraid cyanide is going to pour into their groundwater. And they don't have real friendly things to say about the particular businesses there. And the subtleties of trying to tell them, now when you get up there to protect yourself, because Oregon doesn't have a defense for you yet, and unlike me, you probably don't have an insurance company that's going to defend you. Don't name anybody by name. As Senator Hamby can tell you, that subtlety was distinctly lost. They name people by name, and you simply can't have a legislative process if you're going to get into the nitty-gritty of things like environmental regulation, or as in my case, regulation of the unauthorized practice of law. And as a result of that, I would ask it be adopted.
Are you familiar with the Oregon Supreme Court case of Adamson versus Bonesteel?
No, I'm not. I believe that I've done exhaustive research on it, and if you could hum a few bars.
Well, I tell you what, I hummed a few bars in the Oregon Supreme Court and won the case, and it has to do with the subject matter that you're here on. I would be very surprised if a trial court, much less the Oregon Supreme Court, would say that you didn't have a privilege. I don't know about the need for any thing in the statute, but anyway, the reason that I asked about that opinion is I don't remember all of the language in it. It's decided, I suppose, in the last 2 or 3 years, and it has to do with the privilege of a city council member from the city of Salem to go out and make derogatory comments about somebody who was in the ambulance business. And the court treated the subject of the very subject you're dealing with there. How far can people in the legislative process go in making statements? And I there might be some indication in that case what the court would rule in a case like yours. I was just curious to know whether that was part of the...
That is. I am, now having heard those recitations of the case, I am very familiar with that case. That was cited to the Marion County Court, but it's distinguishable clearly on the facts, because here we're talking about a lay witness, and there you are talking about a person who has this legislative capacity, and there's a big distinction as a result of that. It simply didn't make any difference in the case, and it remains unarticulated. On the other point of I've received words of encouragement from various of my colleagues who say, well, don't worry, Thad, if a $2 million judgment is entered against you, obviously you'll never be able to pay it being a legal aid lawyer. But even if you were, the idea is, of course, then we have to go to the Supreme Court if that happens. My bigger concern is, because this isn't going to affect my case, I'm concerned with the future, and my concern is, in the event that this case is settled, say for there's some discussions on harassment value now, you don't have a precedent yet, and Oregon remains open, and people have been hearing more and more about this particular case and in the legislature, and I simply think the idea is going to be out there among more and more attorneys that you don't like what happened. Time magazine called it the new hush money. One of my colleagues was nice enough to send me a copy of that, of an article from Time in 1985, which simply said that one of the ploys that industry takes now, especially when it comes to testimony about regulating hazardous waste, is you're simply able to intimidate people who, for example, live around places like the Love Canal or something, and they're afraid to testify. When we had the second hearing on this, we were fortunate enough to have Justice Gillette sitting there in the audience there to testify on another bill. And after hearing all that was said, two people from the audience gratuitously got up. One was a lawyer who basically said, my God, I've testified in the legislature time and time again. I always assumed there was an absolute privilege, and it amazes me that this is the case. I also had a call from the director of the Professional Liability Fund who had exactly the same reaction. That's incredible that that we don't have articulated law in Oregon on that. But Justice Gillette got up and basically said, as he so often does with eloquence, that this is a that it's hard for him to imagine a smaller bill that has a larger impact in a democratic society. And I don't think that's an exaggeration.
That's why I doubt very much the Supreme Court would ever find any liability there. But that's another question. Any questions? By the way, Senator Wires.
I was sitting where that empty chair is a few days ago on the Education Committee, and someone sat at the table there happens to be in the chair that's next to you that's now empty, and was calling people that would support the piece of legislation that was being heard communists. And he named a few names and then also generally alluded that people who would support legislation like this were following out the communist idea of infiltrating the education process and so on. And it brought me to muse about whether I felt there should be any limitation. You mentioned that Representative Bunn said that he didn't like the word absolute. I would be interested in your reflections on that. I would say, before you answer, so far my thinking about it, which I haven't really come to any real conclusions, is that we should allow people to say even very, very outrageous things, in spite of the fact that they can be damaging to innocent people, legislators and others. But I'm interested in what your thoughts are on that.
Yes, I'd really like to comment first on the latter point, because it occurs to me, other places that I've lived in the United States and practiced law, that Oregon is a relatively small state. And we have a citizen legislature here. We don't have a geared up all year round professional process that carefully screens the witnesses as say, for example, California, the United States Senate does, for example. And so there's really very little coaching. You're simply brought in, and citizens will rant and rave sometimes and say things that may be defamatory. As to the former point, I am not really sure how Representative Bunn feels about it. I do know that...
Well, I wanted to ask how you felt.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I even mentioned him.
Okay. Well, how I feel about it is, my instinct was, as I said in my letter, which I believe is in your file, was that when absolute immunity, what the language was being taken out, it was a big ouch to me. Like, oh my goodness, here goes the gutting of the bill and the political process. But when I, upon further reflection, I noticed that the first sentence still stayed in, and it states that it shall be, quote, the same as that of a witness in a judicial proceeding, unquote. And because judicial proceedings accord witnesses an absolute immunity, it seemed to me that it didn't matter if some people would be happier having the term absolute immunity taken out, because as long as the judicial immunity is there, it remains absolute. And besides, it goes one step beyond, in my opinion, and that is if you do bring an action against the witness and you want to say that, well, it was an immaterial statement and litigate it, you better win, because otherwise the witness is going to be entitled to attorney's fees. And I think that's really in the spirit of the furtherance of that public policy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
Yes. I'm sorry. Are you saying that the way in the form that the bill is in now, that if it passed, there would be absolute immunity because of the judicial proceeding aspect of it?
Yes. Yes, I'm saying that's exactly what I'm saying, that it is an absolute immunity bill in the same sense that judicial immunity is. It's similar to what Justice Gillette said. He was talking about a judicial immunity for judges, and he basically said that unless you have a bill that just forbids the bringing of a lawsuit at all, absolute immunities aren't really absolute. And I'm not trying here to have a bill that says under any circumstance you can't bring anything. The law would specifically have to say that, and you can't even bring a lawsuit against anybody over it. So in a legal sense, it is an absolute immunity. I think probably in a broader practical sense, it's not. But it seems to me that a judicial immunity has certainly protected witnesses in the courts for years, and I would think that it would serve just as well for witnesses in the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, if I might also follow up with Senator Hill's question, I believe a judicial witness immunity goes only to statements which are in fact material to the proceeding at hand in the court. So, and that would apply here too. The statements must be material to the matter before the legislative committee. You couldn't just take the opportunity of testifying before a legislative committee to go off on a whole separate subject.
Okay. Well, I guess so. If you could be discussing a subject and still go pretty far, because I guess I'm a little trouble with people using that as an opportunity just to come in and say, well, we're talking about this subject, and then sort of like a relating clause on a bill. You know, we've gotten stuff bills, and it can be a totally different subject, really. And I'd like to ask you, the language that was added, unless the witness knowingly makes a false and immaterial statement for the purpose of defaming another. For the purpose of defaming another, I mean, how would you ever prove that a statement was made for the purpose of defaming another?
I believe that essentially it becomes almost a synonym for the term immaterial. And that is, if you're there saying bad things about somebody else, say in this testimony I were to say broach the question of who may have committed adultery before, that is something that, if it's unrelated to this, you might very well assume that I'm trying to defame a political candidate.
But
it's
you,
not this guy.
One more
question.
Oh, yeah. So,
we're not under oath.
You're convinced, though, that this bill would not allow abuses? I mean, for someone to really, I mean, I would hate for someone to be able to really come in here, and simply because we're on a certain subject, and then be able to just launch into someone and say, well, it is related to the subject.
I do believe the bill does allow abuses. And I think that that's an inherent part of the policy balancing that you're undertaking. It's saying, well, some abuses are going to occur and be tolerated. What do we get in exchange for that? And what we get in exchange for that is some of the excited Oregon citizens may come up here and say, this industry are a bunch of swine, and something to the effect that, and these people who feel that way on a bill are just clearly communist or neo-Nazis. And I think that that's what the balance is. And it seems to me that I obviously am in favor of the balance, allowing some abuses, but not the wholly outrageous one where it just isn't even germane to what's going on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I wonder what you think about... It seems to me that there really is a legitimate distinction between a purposeful defamation of a legislator and purposeful defamation of a private citizen. I don't have any compunction at all about giving absolute immunity to citizens to say anything they want about people in the legislature. I have some qualms, though, about... I have some qualms about giving that right to people to defame other private citizens. Do you see a similar distinction or not?
I certainly see a similar distinction, but again, I look at it in terms of the policy balance, and so much of the business that occurs these days in a legislature, and I don't know in a judiciary committee whether that's necessarily the case, but I'm sure in the agricultural committee, for example, it does, concerns specific kind of bad things that happen places in the state of Oregon. And the witnesses there, they're not in command of a generic knowledge. They're citizens who come in, and they want to talk about this corporation or this individual. And I do see a distinction, but I think that the policy balance still should favor the free and open testimony, as long as it's material.
Okay, now what is the status of your own case? Where is it now? Is it pending for trial, or
it's just finished the third amended complaint against me, and I assume it'll go for a fourth amended complaint, but it should be tried within this decade, to my knowledge.
Now, I noticed that subsection 2 was apparently an afterthought. It was added in after the bill was printed. Can you give me the rationale why that was added?
I'd like to defer, if I could, to Diana, since she was expressly involved in that.
And I drafted that, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Diana Godwin. I worked closely with Representative Bunn on this, and he was aware that when he was putting in these qualifiers, saying, well, your immunity is not absolute, you may still be liable if you make a false and immaterial statement for the purpose of defaming another. So he realized he was pulling back from an absolute immunity. And he said, in exchange, however, I don't want that that language to, again, open up witnesses to constant lawsuits, because just merely the threat of a lawsuit, even though the witness may win it under this language, is enough to chill the democratic process and the free exchange of information. So he said, I want to make sure that if the witness is wrongfully sued, that they can get attorney fees, and therefore restore a little bit of balance. And that is why that subsection 2 was put in. And I did draft that with Representative Bunn.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, that would be the only instance where in a defamation action a prevailing defendant would be entitled to reasonable attorney fees. And I'm wondering why we should single out a certain class of defendants in defamation cases for that.
Because I think, if I might, Mr. Chairman, talking with Representative Bunn about that, I clarified with him that he intended to have it a prevailing defendant fee, and he says, yes, that's right. Again, because of the critical public policy, you wanted to make sure the public policy of encouraging free and open exchange in the legislature was encouraged. He felt that that was an important enough public policy to be preserved, to take an exception, as you say, to the usual rule in defamation cases.
Well, considering what's happened with New York Times versus Sullivan and all the emphasis upon freedom of the press, it seems to me that there's just as much reason to say to people who bring defamation actions against media defendants that if they lose, they have to pay reasonable attorney's fees, as there is in this case here. And I'll say that in either case, do I think that's a good idea.
May I respond to that, Senator? Okay. I would like to say this legislature is, in fact, on record giving special protection to the media. We have the libel and slander laws in this state. We have a whole nice little section for the media to protect them, and it requires this giving of notice within 30 days of the defamatory comment, as I recall. So I think that legislative ways of advancing the public policy when the exceptions are justified is a good idea.
All right. Well, I'm... Yeah, okay. I'm... quite familiar with the provisions of the Oregon Retraction Law.
Yes, I remember.
And I can see the policy reasons and considerations. That just jumped out at me, though, when you are going to award reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing defendant. But that's just my thoughts. All right, any other comments or thoughts on this? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
It's a very interesting issue. There's no question about that. As you can tell, I am interested in the issue. Is there anyone else who didn't get a chance to sign up now on House Bill 2724?
Thank you, Senator Frye, members of the committee. I intended to testify.
Tell us your name again, please.
John Chess of AFACT, American Freemen Against Communist Tyranny. And I'm honored that I'm the subject of the discussion today by Senator Wyers. I like to state for the record that he lied. I called nobody a communist. But I did ask you one question. I have a communist front flyer upon which the Communist Party is listed and several of its objectives here in the state of Oregon. I asked him why his name was on that list, and he's very upset about that. He doesn't want to answer the question. Now, why isn't he man enough to sit with me instead of make a show on
this bill now, or do you want to make a speech?
I've said all I want to say.
Okay. This bill, by the way, would be very helpful to you.
Yes, it would. I'm surprised. At first, I suspected it would cut off my testimony.
Oh, no.
But I resent Mr. Senator Wyers' lies when he says I called somebody a communist.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
As I recall, Senator Wyers did not mention anybody's name.
Right, he didn't.
Thank you.
But it's in the record who was in that chair.
All right. Well, we'll close the public hearing on 2724. We'll go to House Bill 2304. Okay, David Marcus, please.
Mr. Chairman, may I request that I be joined by Terry Rogers at this time?
Definitely, yes, of course.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Marcus. I am the president of the Oregon Association of Administrative Law Judges. Our lobbyist, Max Ray, who prepared the written testimony for today's hearing, which you should all have copies of, had to be out of town today and is unable to be present for this hearing. I am also currently employed as a hearings referee with the Motor Vehicles Division. However, I'm appearing today on behalf of the association on my own time. House Bill 2304 is a fairly simple bill, actually. The basic purpose of the bill is to establish a formal vehicle for reviewing, studying, and recommending improvements in the various administrative hearings processes used by state agencies. Particular concerns to be focused on include review of hearings officers' orders, hearings personnel matters, workload and efficiency issues, as well as matters relating to centralization with the consideration of the systems and experiences of other states. The bill establishes a 13-member commission, four of whom would be representatives from the House and the Senate. One would be a designated employee of the Department of Justice selected by the Attorney General, and then eight appointments by the governor with a fairly broad spectrum from government, including two administrative agency heads, two hearings officers or referees, and then members from the private legal community. The bill requires no appropriation to be carried out, and we would specifically request that this committee lift the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The purpose of the commission would be to perform the study and report back to the next legislative session in 1989, and we would urge your support and speedy approval of this measure. Thank you.
Terry, did you have something?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid, and on behalf of individual Legal Aid clients, I am testifying in favor of House Bill 2304. We are also in support of the bills in this time creating a Division of Independent Hearing Officers. However, I think it's unlikely that that's going to happen, The issue has been before the legislature since 1977. Legal Aid feels that it is high time that a commission be appointed so that during the interim the issue can be really grappled with. And it really is a very important issue because it goes to the heart of whether decisions are really impartial decisions at the administrative law level. Our clients come into a welfare hearing and are faced with an employee of the agency holding the hearing. And they have a very hard time thinking that the proceeding is unbiased and that the individual will be uninfluenced by the pressures within the agency. And in fact, in the Adult and Family Services Division, the actual hearing decisions are reviewed by first the head of the hearings unit, then the income maintenance section, then the assistant administrator of the division, and sometimes the administrator of the division. One of the things that this produces is changed hearing decisions, and another thing that it produces is incredible delays. Last month, we had 19 cases that were beyond the time limit for deciding cases, which is 90 days. Some cases have taken as long as 8 months from the Adult and Family Services Division. Basically, we feel that the issue at hand is very important because it is not only a question of justice, but the perception of justice. The administrative hearings system is the day in court for thousands and thousands of Oregon citizens, not just poor people, by any means. So I am delighted to be able to...
And some other portions of this bill, whereby that they will invariably challenge 50% of the writs that are issued covering a small, relatively small consumer debts, such as the $300 doctor dental bill, the hardware store, bad checks, what have you, which is the backbone of an agency's activities. The second portion is subgroup E, wherein each writ must include a notice to the defendant that he may contest the writ's incorrect figures by filing a claim of exemption. If all other portions of this bill were to be approved, this is the one that should be taken out of this document. And the reason for that being is that it specifically states that the judgment debtor can ask for an exemption hearing challenging the validity of the garnishment anywhere from the time that it is served on the garnishee defendant for 180 days subsequent to that time. That is 6 months. So in theory, this is what, in my opinion, based on my years of experience, will happen in more instances than one would like to contemplate. And that is that John Doe finds his wages garnished for a $240 doctor bill, if you will, or he didn't pay for the lawnmower repair or whatever you have in this range, $300-$400. He finds his wages garnished. He is aware by virtue of the statement that has to be included and mailed to him by the service organization, whether it be the sheriff or the private process serving company, advising him of his right to file a claim of exemption and have a hearing in court challenging the validity of that writ. This can only foster the legal aid, your government attorneys, to file these types of challenges. It's burdensome enough to fend them off already, what with the truth in lending statutes, the many Miranda laws and so forth that have to be complied with already. This only poses another burden and it not gives the opportunity to legal aid to challenge these things. Further, if myself in operating a collection agency, even though it is a small, closely held corporation, I would be placing the entire operation in jeopardy if I should take upon myself to sign writs of garnishment under the certification portions of this bill. If legal aid were to challenge the validity of the writ and ask for a hearing based on that, being a closely held family corporation, although I could issue the writ I could not represent myself at that summary hearing before the court. ORS Chapter 9 and something requires that all corporations be represented by attorneys before the court. So, in theory, I issue a writ under the provisions of this law. It is challenged by the judgment debtor, and he asks for an exemption hearing. I have tied up, as a result of the garnishment, say 25% of his disposable income, which the statute provides, and they generally run in the area of $90 to $140. So I have, say, let's just say $100 held under the writ. I operate in the near southwest side of Portland, but I do the majority of my business in Washington County, with the county seat being in Hillsborough. I have to be represented at that hearing by an attorney, or else it goes by forfeiture, and I lose everything thus far. So I call my attorney and I say, hey, we've got an exemption hearing scheduled for such and such a day at Hillsborough. Can you represent me? Yes, I'll be there. Attorneys' hourly billings run from the area of $75 to $100 an hour. No attorney that I know of in my 25 years of experience is going to drive from downtown Portland to Hillsborough to represent me at that hearing, but what he's going to bill me at least 1 hour, in all likelihood, 2 hours.
Can't drive out there and back in an hour.
Beg your pardon?
Can't drive out there and back in an hour.
Well, that's what I'm saying, sir. At the minimum of 1 hour, I'm out $75 to $100, in all likelihood, 2 hours. So if I have $90 under execution, or I mean under the writ of garnishment, and I have to pay my attorney $150 to $200 just to defend myself, it becomes economically unfeasible to bother with it in the first place. So I feel that provision of the bill, recognizing that 40% of all debts that are assigned to a collection agency that assets can be found on, many of them aren't, obviously, but assets whereby the fellow has a job, he is working, he has other articles subject to his execution. Of those, 4 out of 10 will result in some sort of legal action being taken to compel payment. Obviously, why would we want to sue the fellow if he's going to pay the bill anyway? So we bring an action to recover this just debt. The court feels that it's a just debt, renders this judgment, but at the same time handcuffs us in our ability to effectively and economically recover on the order of the court. And that is the very essence of this problem with this exemption statute. It can make it economically unfeasible for anyone in a relatively small business, such as a collection agency is, except for a couple of very large multi-state organizations in Portland, are by and large a cottage-type industry, in that the owners are local, they deal directly with the merchants and so forth. And this portion of it could theoretically make it economically impossible to be in the garnishment business, absent the ability to effectively have funds withheld from paychecks will result in a direct loss of 20% of the revenue derived to the agency. We're not going to do writs of garnishment knowing that 1 out of 5 is going to be challenged in court. Good theory behind this, and I'd like to point that out. Say, for example, we did a writ of garnishment on the fellow's bank account and held $1,000. Our commission rates on that recovery is 35%. So if the funds were paid over, the agency would be entitled to $350. But if we have to spend $150 just to overcome some frivolous claim of exemption, then our commission rates drop to net 20%. And I submit that there is no collection agency in the state of Oregon, regardless of how sophisticated they may be with electronics and computerization, et cetera, can be in business at 20% commission rates. It's not possible. It's absolutely impossible. And no agency will accept any claims anywhere, anytime for 20%. So that each time a claim of exemption is filed under this statute, it simply compromises the ability to effectively deal with a debtor. Transposing that into the prospect of a small businessman, There are many businesses in Portland that make a great deal of use of the small claims court without benefit of an agency. They collect their own accounts receivable. They do utilize the courts. But with this on their shoulders, they're going to ask many times themselves, if I sue this fellow, he's already told me where to go, he's made references to my family tree, etc., so I can anticipate what he's going to do. So I'm going to have to sue and wind up garnishing this fellow. But if I do, and he claims exemptions, then I'm spent throwing good money, perhaps after bad, and let alone that specter, what about bankruptcy? He loses the exemption hearing, so then promptly files bankruptcy, and we give it all back to him anyway. Because
could
of the 40-day
I interrupt you a minute now?
Right. But let me go on, if I may, sir.
Well, let me interrupt you a minute, though.
Okay.
Now, you know, this is really, this hearing was not designed to accommodate witnesses who should have appeared at the regular public hearing. It's only really to discuss the new amendments that came up after the last public hearing. So I'm kind of extending the committee on this to accommodate you people. I don't know why we didn't hear from you at the regular public hearing, but go ahead and try to sum up for us if you would.
Okay, I will. The bill provides for a civil penalty of $100 if the garnishee if the judgment debtor files frivolous claims. To the judgment debtor, $100 civil penalty in the court is nothing. That's water off a duck's back. My experience has been that the court, in general, would not impose any civil sanctions on the judgment debtor. And I've already covered the aspect of the government lawyers. I'll skip on. Section 6, paragraph 1, time factors relating to filing claims of exemption, it provides the ability for the judgment debtor to file his claim of exemption 180 days later. This would have an adverse effect on all small businesses in the state that utilize the small claims court and rely on these procedures because, say, for example, we as a small collection agency have this $1,000 case that we just cited a few moments ago. We prevail in the exemption hearing, perhaps. That would be fine, and our commission would go down to 20%, but no exemption hearing is filed. And the statutes in Oregon require that we disperse to our client 25 days after the close of the calendar month in which the collection was affected, so that we then, in turn, disperse to our customer his portion of the debt. And 4 or 5 months later, the fellow files a claim of exemption. We then have to front all of that expense back because it puts us in a very awkward position going back to our customers saying, this is what's going on. We got to have that $400 back. It just makes no sense to allow a 180-day period of time for him to do that.
Yeah, why? I wonder why you and Mr. Bray weren't here at the public hearing on this.
Mr. Chairman, I was totally unaware of this bill until the process service company that I use brought it to my attention last week.
Well, it's too late it's too late for a general hearing on this whole bill. If you have something to say about have you seen the proposed amendments now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have.
If you want to direct your attention to anything in the amendments, and I would go ahead. Otherwise, I'm sure the committee members all have read your statement here, or Mr. Moore's statement, so it's not as if we haven't had the whole thing.
I understand.
Let me ask you one question, though. How long does it take you to get a writ of garnishment out of the district court in Multnomah County, or the circuit court, for that matter?
Circuit court, same day. The district court, anywhere from 7 to 14 days. However, we use the Justice Court, and it's same day at the Justice Court.
Mr. Bray, what about Marion County District Court? How many days to get a writ?
Approximately 7 out of district.
7 days in District Court in Marion County. All right. Any questions of Mr. Swanson? Thank you, sir. Ron Summers, and I give you the same admonition that I just gave to Mr. Swanson, I don't want to go over a ground that should have been plowed in the public hearing. You were here for that.
I was here for the hearing,
Mr. Chairman. So if you want
to talk
about the amendments, then that's fine.
I do.
Okay.
I'd like to...
Tell us on the record who you are and where you're from.
For the record, I'm Ron Summers from the Dalles. And I'd like to address some of the amendments to the bill, realizing that they were just handed to me at the hearing and apparently have just been printed today in accordance with the bill. I'd like to advise the members of the committee that the Oregon State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure was unanimously opposed to this bill in its present form and the amended version. And that includes the gentleman who was alluded to earlier as having approved it being on the debtor-creditor committee. He was in a minority on that executive committee. And the members of the bar are extremely concerned about this bill, and let me explain to you some of the reasons. Despite
They're
the
all new reasons, Ali. You didn't give us the other day when you testified.
They are new reasons.
All right.
Okay? Looking at this bill, I believe you just received a word from Brad that it takes out the lawyer from the process. And I believe you all sat there and you listened to it, and none of you questioned it. I'd ask you to look at page 4 of the bill.
I don't think you said that, but...
He doesn't? He didn't?
I don't think
I may
Mr.
have
Frank
misunderstood
that,
it. Maybe Mr. Carlson can correct me.
I don't remember Mr. Swank saying anything. My comment was that it no longer had people paying the attorney, but I didn't say anything about having it eliminate attorneys
from
the bill.
Let's read together from page 4 of the bill. I call your attention to subparagraph A of small subparagraph H. If the garnishee disperses payment to the plaintiff or to the plaintiff's attorney, which specifically by statute authorizes the payment to the attorney, on the date the garnishee disperses or should disperse payment as required under ORS 29-235. Now, if that isn't a negative pregnant, allowing a disbursement to the attorney and the concomitant conflicts that arise, the nexus that we are concerned with in the amended bill stems from Section 2 of the bill and Section 2 on page 2 of the bill, as you have today, and that allows the attorney or an active member of the Oregon State Bar to issue one or more writs. And the problem that has occurred that the proposers of this bill seem to be overlooking, a system that has worked in excess of 150 years in the state, is that garnishments go through the clerk for a purpose. And I'm going to say on the record that when I spoke to Justice Peterson, he was unaware of the procedure of how the garnishments work in this state, as are many trial judges and apparently some of the Supreme Court judges. The problem is there is a journal, and the judgments all go through the journal. All proceedings that are take place in that case have to go through the journal. There's nothing in this bill that allows a proper indexing so a person can keep track of the judgment and the monies paid on the judgment, because it takes it out of the judicial system. What the amended bill does with Section 2 in it and subsection 2 of Section 2 is a patent admission that the judicial administration of judgments is broken down. What we object to is the additional liability it imposes on lawyers. Now, being a member of the bar for 25 years, I should be championing the cause to have more rights limited for attorneys. But for those of you who practice law, you have to realize, as one gentleman alluded to, we are self-insured. Members of the bar are self-insured and pay into a fund each year, which the Chief Justice and the members of his staff do not have to pay into. And an improperly issued garnishment under this statute opens a lawyer to a 1983 claim.
I don't think that that's anything that we didn't know about when we heard this in the regular public hearing, though.
It was not brought up in the public hearing.
Well, it could have been brought up, couldn't it?
Pardon?
It could have been brought up.
I suppose it could have been brought up.
I don't have the time to go through this thing as if it were a first public hearing. That's all there is to it.
Well, we'd ask that Section 2 be taken out of Section 2. We'd ask also that if the garnishee disperses payment to the plaintiff on subparagraph A on page 4, that be taken out, that it not go to the attorney or his trust account because of the concomitant problems. If you have any other questions, there is a memorandum here that was prepared by Mr. Comstock on the bill. It does not cover all the amendments. I sense that the committee has already made up its mind to move the bill out.
I think you're wrong in that impression. I know that. I think you're absolutely wrong.
I don't know. We are very, very concerned about it.
Well, I can tell that you are. There's no doubt about that in our minds.
As to what the other gentleman testified to, even though he was testifying against the bill, I'd like to say, in fairness to the Judicial Department staff, that the right to object to a garnishment is 180 days, and that's written into the statute, and that's not a new provision.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Summers? All right. Senator Wires.
I was just thinking that Mr. Summers would probably agree that my explanation of the word negative pregnant was right. If somebody says, you're cheating me all the time, and the person says, I didn't cheat you 10 times, that's a partial admission that you may have cheated them 8 times. Would that be a...
Not
I didn't
a
use the word
pregnant.
Cheat, but we got...
Great.
Thank you very
Yesterday
much.
Yesterday we had race ipsa loquitur. Today we got negative pregnancy around here. Yes, counsel has a question.
Mr. Summers, I've taken a look at the garnishment statute. I haven't taken a look at any of the cases, but I keep hearing references to the clerks currently checking the writs, and I'm wondering where in statute or case law there is either authority for or requirement on the clerks to check the writs. It looks to me as though
I can't give you the statutory reference, but if you look under the duties of the court, they're required to keep a journal, have so done for 150 years in this state. Each time a writ execution or any process or paper is received into a case or an issuance made, the clerk makes an entry in the journal. And that keeps a multiplicity of writs being issued. See, this would allow an attorney, two attorneys in the same office, not knowing what's going on, to issue more writs of garnishment than could be legal, subjecting to the 1983 violation. See, until you get into working with it on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't make much sense, see? But when you see it and why it has worked for 150 years, we're very upset with changing it and the mode that it goes on.
Okay. All right, Ron. Thanks for being here. Jason Crow, please.
My name is Jason Crow. I'm from Portland. I'm president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers. My concerns have been voiced. These gentlemen have taken care of it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your... As Senator Hill would say when he's chairing the business committee, your succinct testimony. Bob Donaldson, please.
I'm Bob Donaldson. I'm a lawyer that practices here in Salem. I have offices in Portland, too. Our firm is, I guess, one way to be that you could characterize it as a creditor's rights firm. We do an awful lot of collection practice, primarily business and commercial collection practices. And I'm in favor of this bill. I think it would be very useful to us. And the problem is, and you've identified some of it here, is that the clerks are not uniformly responsive to the needs of the judgment creditor. And although some of the district courts are getting writs out on a very timely fashion, the circuit courts aren't always that timely. And sometimes we're dealing with judgments here that aren't, like you've heard earlier, where we're talking about $100 or $1,000, but we might be talking about $30,000 or $50,000 or $1 million or something. And you've got, and time is of the essence, and you know that money is going to be at a particular place at a particular time, and you have a legal right to that if you can get to it. And it's awfully frustrating to get your writ together, and you've got all the numbers down, the interest is perfect, the assessments are perfect, you take it down to the clerk, and the clerk takes 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks to sign their name to a piece of paper that's absolutely perfect. And we see that problem time and time again. And this eliminates that. Now, there's been some criticism here that, I think one gentleman put it, that the court's going to lose control. Well, we've already in our office, and we solved that problem. We know what those expenses are going to be, and the problem is that the court's dockets aren't always up to speed, up to date, and so we're not getting these writs issued out timely. This would solve that problem. The responsibility for the record keeping, the bookkeeping, is maybe going to be shifted to the lawyer's office. We already assume that responsibility in our office. I don't see that as a big deal, a big problem.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Counsel.
Mr. Donaldson, as a practical matter, and the kind of judgments you're talking about, do clerks check the accuracy of the writ?
Well, they do.
Is there anything they do?
Some counties do and some counties don't. And you know, you raise the question, where's the authority come from? And in some counties, the clerks say, you know, we'll take your numbers, and they sign off on them, and that's fine. You get quick response time. In Marion County, they've always checked that, and we've asked them, what's the authority for that? You know, well, we've done it for 150 years or something. And, you know, we haven't. And by golly, we're going to do it, you know, and we're going to do it when we get to it. The work over there, I don't want to throw stones. They've got a very, very heavy workload. But the problem is that, by golly, you've got a client that has a claim. You've litigated the claim. You've gone through the process. You've finally got that piece of paper where you can do something with it. And, you know, so what do? You've got a writ of execution or a writ of garnishment, and you actually even know where there's some money that you can help satisfy your client's claim that he has a legal right to, and it gets all bollocked up over the courthouse. And this simply solves that problem.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Hemby.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, you've heard negative testimony prior from the previous witnesses.
Right.
In your mind, is there any valid complaint?
Yeah, probably should.
I didn't like what they said. No, I think, to give you an honest answer to that, a lot of the criticisms about, we heard about exemptions and handling of exemptions and so forth, that's existing law. And one of the nice things that this statute provides is it puts all that stuff that is in various places in the statute book all in one location. And a lot of the I think I knew all those exemptions, but I've never ever before seen them all listed in one place like that. And I think that's useful in dealing with the system. I think that, you know, there's two sides to the controversy, and I think that if we're attempting to garnish something and someone has a claim to an exemption, they ought to be able to know about that, and they ought to be able to raise the claim, and making the system more clear and helping people communicate within the system is a good idea. And so I think that really there isn't anything new, I don't think, in those criticisms. They were there. It's just that we focused their attention on them because they're all listed in one place, it appears.
All right. Thanks again. All right. Now, I think this is a complicated issue, and I don't think I understand all of the nuances of this bill any better than anybody. Maybe I understand them less than anybody on this committee, but I'm still floundering around with this issue, and I think the other committee members are too. So I'm going to have Brad Swank come back now and try to help us understand some of these comments that were made here, if you can, or respond to them if you want.
Well, one of the problems that we ran into when we were working on this bill was the diversity of opinion about what was going on with garnishments about the state.
in terms not only of attorneys who are supposed to know the law, but of process servers and other people. And it's been, I should say my name for the record again. For the record, I'm Brad Swank with State Court Administrator's Office. And there's a diversity of practice around the state, and it's one of the problems, and it's one of the expenses of the courts, and it's one of the incredible inefficiencies, is that you go from one county to another, and each county does it a little differently, and it's hard for us to tell what's going on. Not only that, but there's an incredible amount of time spent with people calling in on the telephone asking clerks what they do in that particular county. Some of the points that were raised, that people have raised in the testimony, they say if this bill passes, clerks will stop checking the writs. We have been telling clerks not to check the writs forever. There is no statutory requirement. There's no statutory authority. When they do that, not only do they slow down the process, but they bring potential additional liability onto the state for checking something that they may not know about. They have no more way than an attorney of knowing whether or not there's been a direct payment outside of the legal process of this judgment, a partial payment. We have no way of knowing that because we don't keep records of those direct payments now. That's in between them. That's why the claim of exemption process is set up. If you claim something, then the people have a right to file this claim of exemption. We haven't changed that. The other argument about the 180 days and it being too long a period of time.
Mike? Well, yeah, I didn't know whether. Is he waiting for somebody to come down? Excuse me for interrupting here. But
okay.
All right, he's going to lunch.
Okay.
Go ahead.
180 days may well be too long a period for a claim of exemption. We're not arguing whether it's too long or not too long. It just happens to be current law. We haven't changed that. We kept all of the rights in relation to debtors who owe under the bill. They've still got 180 days. There's still a 10-day hold period protecting these debtors when the money is paid. And that was the point about the argument about payments to attorneys. We allowed for payments to attorneys under bills, but we didn't require that the payments be made to them and that they hold for the 10-day period. And that was the objection that Mark Comstock had and that the debtor-creditor section had. And so we eliminated that provision that said they had to hold for 10 days. That hold period is done by the garnishee the same way it is under the clerk-issued writ. Again, it's a choice. You don't have to have attorney-issued writs. In terms of records, there is some confusion about what records would be kept. We would basically have the same information in the court records that we have now. The bill provides that when a writ of garnishment is issued, the clerk of court gets a writ of garnishment, gets a copy of that, mailed back, and we file that the same way we file it now. If you've looked at the forms that are in the statute,